This is Audible.
From Simon & Schuster Audio, Forever by Pete Hamill. Read by Stevie Ray Dallimore. With an afterword read by the author.
Part 1. Ireland. There he is, 3 days after his 5th birthday, standing barefoot upon wet summer grass. He is staring at the house where he lives, the great good Irish place of whitewashed walls, long and low, with a dark slate roof glistening in the morning drizzle. Standing there, he knows it will turn pale blue when the sun appears to work its magic. The boy, named Robert Carson, loves gazing at that house. On some days, a wisp of smoke rises from the chimney. On other days, the early morning sun throws a golden glaze upon its white facade. It is never the same, and always the same. Robert Carson goes in, flipping the iron latches made by his father, whose name is John Carson and is called simply Da. A sweet odor of burning turf fills the air. He breathes it deeply, inhaling the ancient burned mud of the swamps beside Loch Ness, where the peat was cut from the bog. Directly facing him is the jam wall, running from floor to ceiling along the side of the hearth. The hearth is the center of the house, the holy place that holds the fire. On damp, chilly days, the boy sits on one of the hand-carved low benches beside the fire. The family has few visitors, but men always sit on the right, facing the fire, so the boy does the same. The women take the bench on the left, and his mother is always there. Her name is Rebecca, but he calls her Ma. To the left of the hearth is a small, iron crane his father made in the forge, with its arms of different lengths and hooks for hanging pots. His mother moves the pots back and forth in and out of the flame, while the odors of stews and porridges and soups overwhelm the sweetness of the burning turf. Back about 5 feet from the hearth is his father's own chair, made of woven rush, looking like a throne designed as a beehive. Robert Carson never sits in his father's chair. A wide oaken shelf spreads above the hearth, and he can see with his eyes shut the objects that occupy its oiled surface. His father's clay pipes, with their long curved stems, an old thatched horse collar that Da saved from his own youth, a carved wooden cup called a noggin found in the mud of a bog. Da has told the boy that the noggin is 1,000 years old, and Robert Carson is certain that his father is right. To the left, a mound of turf bricks rises off the floor, dried out of dark black bottom mud. The iron tools of the fire stand as rigid as sentries. All are part of the hearth, where the fire burns low but is never allowed to go out. On his birthday, while they faced the hearth, his mother told the boy that his magic number would be 9, for he was born on the 9th of September. Sometimes, on rainy afternoons, when his father is working in the forge, the boy's mother sits beside the fire to drink tea and eat oat bread while she tells stories. Her voice makes a kind of music. They are the first stories of his life, written on a 5-year-old's emptiness. He is awake and asleep at the same time, listening to the magical words, while becoming, through his mother's magic, the people in the stories. The fire burns steadily in the hearth, and his mother tells him that the fire should never be allowed to go out, because if it does, the soul leaves the house. Da agrees. There were houses in Ireland, he said once, where the fire had burned day and night for more than 100 years. In this house, he said, it had burned since John and Rebecca Carson moved in, long ago, before the boy was born. Robert Carson later learns that before he was born, there were 2 other children, his brothers, who were born and then died in another house. And when they died, Da poured water into the hearth and moved to this place to begin again. To the left of the hearth is the door to the bedroom where his mother and father sleep each night. A dresser stands outside the door, its drawers holding clothes. To the dresser's left is the back door leading to the west. He knows that no stranger should ever leave through the back door, because he would take with him the luck of the house. He knows, too, that when there's a death in the house, the coffin must leave through that same back door to be taken to the west, to the setting sun, and the blackness that follows. On the ceiling, great beams cut from bog oak form a huge A, supporting the layers of thatch and sod that lie beneath the slates. His father built this house to last. The walls are brick, stone, cut rushes that had soured, all bound together and made smooth by river mud and lime wash. They are 2 feet thick, a house built like a fortress. Even when he is alone, he is safe. His father was a blacksmith, John Carson. The forge stood about 40 yards from the house at a muddy crossroads beside a stream.
"Those horses need shoes," he would say. "Those mail carriages need their wheels repaired."
And so he built his forge first, before he built the house, before Robert came into the world. The forge was the heart of the shop, as the hearth was the soul of the house. At some point, without ceremony, his father gave him the gift of work. He was allowed to work the bellows. His skin pebbled when he saw the fire suddenly brighten from his own efforts. In those hours in the forge, his father would say almost nothing. The smoke and sparks rose from the fire into an iron canopy and then through a metal chimney into the empty sky. On cold, clear winter nights, the boy would sometimes gaze at the distant stars and wonder if they were frozen sparks from his father's forge. He asked his father about this one chilly night.
"Aye," he said. "They all go up into the universe, son."
"Do they ever burn out?"
"Never. When you see a shooting star, lad, that's a spark trying to find its way home."
The most important of all the things in that shop was the anvil. Powerful, mysterious, indestructible, and magical. It was the only object in the shop not made by his father. The anvil had come from Scotland and weighed exactly 171 pounds. The shape was simple and elegant, a kind of small table with a great curved shoulder called the horn. The body was iron, but the face on top was made of steel 2 inches thick. When his father struck it with a hammer, the ringing sound rose into the air and sometimes was answered by the calls of birds. When the sun began to set in the west and his father was finished for the day, he would hang the bellows on a high hook against one wall to keep it from small dangerous invaders, then sit a while in silence, and then walk to the house. On Saturday nights, after the boy was sent to bed, his father bathed in a large wooden waterproof tub lashed with iron bands he'd made himself, the joint so tight not a drop ever touched the flagstone floor. One Saturday night, when Robert was 6, he saw his father enter the new room that he was building as an addition to the house, the room where the boy soon would sleep. The boy slipped off his cot and eased into the shadows to watch him. His father untied the cords of the burlap package and removed the skull of a horse. Robert's heart tripped. On one of their walks to Belfast that summer, his mother had shown the boy a horse's skull off to the side of the road, bone white and sad. The Carsons did not own a horse, and that lonesome skull made Robert whisper a growing desire to ride a horse. He told his mother that above all he wanted to ride a horse with his father. His mother hugged him that afternoon and said,
"Aye, a horse.
I'll talk about it with your father." Dad gazed at the skull for a long moment, holding it in two hands as if it were a chalice, and then in the light of the lantern, he squatted low and began to mix mortar in a tray, thickening it with dry straw. He placed the skull in a hollow place in the wall and then used the mortar and some kiln bricks to hide it. Then he paused, placed his fingertips against the now blank wall, bowed his head, and spoke for a minute in a strange, clotted language. Robert hurried back to the makeshift cot and lay awake with his eyes closed and his heart thumping with excitement. A horse's skull in the western wall! He heard a smooth click as his father shut the door of the unfinished room, hiding the wall with its new and secret resident. Dad's boots fell separately to the floor. He walked on bare feet across the flagstones and knocked gently on the bedroom door. The boy's mother whispered words Robert could not understand. Then she was at the hearth, her smell altering the air, and the boy heard her pouring water into the great tub. Water that gurgled. Water that murmured. Eyes shut tight, the boy heard a rustling of clothes, and then Da's voice saying, "Ah," as he eased into the water. Then there was another unbinding of clothes. Silence. Then she said,
"Oh."
Robert opened his eyes, squinting so they couldn't see what he was seeing. His mother was standing in the tub facing his father, her flesh ripe and flushed in the orange light of the hearth, her breasts full and dark nippled, her belly round with a thick black V of hair below. She squatted and slipped into the water with Da, and Robert closed his eyes in shame and fear. He could hear small splashes of water, wordless grunts of approval, a sighing stillness, a chuckle, and then silence again. The slippery sound of water and soap, of hands on flesh, a long, soaking silence like peace. Finally, the sloshing sound of a body rising from water, and the boy peeked again. His mother was drying herself with a rough cotton towel, smiling, drying under one heavy breast and then the other. His father rose from the water. Robert closed his eyes. His father was seldom in the house. He had customers in the shop, travelers, wayfarers, men with horses needing shoes, or men awaiting sickles to be carried to harvests, or men with ruined tools to be ground and hammered into second lives. They called him Mr. Carson if they were strangers, or John if they'd been there more than once. Sometimes, when the moon was high, the boy saw other men emerge from darkness, great burly men with wild orange hair, their shirts cut from animal skins, and Da stopped work and retreated with them into the tool room. They used the language Robert heard when his father buried the horse's skull in the wall, and they never called him John. At other times, Da borrowed a horse and packed his tools and kissed Robert's mother on the cheek and then rode off into the hills. He was gone for 3 or 4 days, a week. The boy was always afraid that he would never return. "He has work to do," his mother said. "There's so few like him. He needs to help people who can't do what he can." There were no houses near them and no children his age with whom Robert could play, and yet he was not lonely. He often spoke with Bran, their dog, and the dog understood him. Bran had dark red hair and a setter's long nose. Sometimes he threw sticks and Bran raced after them, his ears flapping, his legs a blur. In the house, Robert helped his mother as she prepared food or tended the fire. Peddlers came by in horse-drawn carts, and his mother haggled with them in her teasing way and bought what she needed. Or they would go to town together for beef and fish. They walked to Belfast on Saturday mornings, passing St. Edmund's Anglican Church into lanes gradually more crowded with farmhouses and people. Many houses were crowned with English flags, but even they had molted into permanent gray under the steady gray rain and the steady gray smoke from the coal fires. The only flashes of color came from the scarlet jackets of the English soldiers. In Belfast, the boy never felt part of the people, and, he was sure, neither did his mother. As he waited outside the shops, boys stared at him, at his clothes, at his face.
"What are ye?"
they'd say.
"Papist or prod?"
And the boy learned to answer,
"Prod,"
because he thought that was what he was, a Protestant named Robert Carson. The trip home from Belfast always filled Robert with relief and expectation. Sometimes his mother even skipped along, singing a song, accented by Bran's sharp barks, all of them happy to leave the grim city behind. At home, on all days, Robert loved watching his mother transform the raw materials of their journeys into sumptuous meals. She then vanished into the bedroom and washed her face and hands, and always donned the silver earrings the boy's father had made for her long before Robert Carson was born. They were each shaped as double spirals, with small clips that attached them to the lobes of her ears. When his father came home, they ate gloriously tasty stews. But there was more to Rebecca Carson than cooking, or cleaning, or guarding the life of the fire. Across those endless days when Da was in the shop, she was teaching her son many things. To read, for example. There were few books in Ireland then, but they owned a large Bible, and she read the stories with the boy, or told her own versions of the tales. Over and over again, he asked her to tell him the story of Joseph and his brothers and the coat of many colors. She told it in different ways each time. Sometimes it was a simple tale of vanity. When he was a boy, Joseph had a coat of many colors and was vain about it, flaunting the coat before his brothers. Which is why, when his father sent him to find the brothers in the desert where they were tending flocks, they first thought of killing him and then sold him to some passing men on camels. Sometimes the tale was told as a story of exile. In Egypt, Joseph came to manhood as a slave.
A slave is someone owned by somebody else,
Rebecca Carson explained in a grave voice.
They have to work for that person and don't get paid. They still have them in America, the slaves, I mean, and a few other places, too.
When the boy was a week short of 6 years old, he started school. The schoolhouse stood to the right of St. Edmund's, Church of Ireland, where his father and mother joined the other proud Protestants each Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. The teacher was the same Reverend Robinson who thundered on Sundays. The curriculum was simple: reading, writing, arithmetic, and Protestantism.
How can you tell a Catholic from a Protestant? The Reverend Robinson asked one day.
By his rotted teeth,
someone said. And someone else shouted,
By the smell, idiot.
Hear, hear, the Reverend Robinson commanded. Don't call a fellow Protestant an idiot.
Robert had never heard any of this at home, and so he said nothing. He saved his religious fervor for Bible class. He could talk about Moses and Abraham and Isaac, and about Aaron's rod, which was a shepherd's staff, and how Aaron could turn it into a snake or use it to change water into blood. He did make some friends: Billy Painter, Sam Longley, Tommy Hastings, boys like those from town, but better dressed, with faces shiny and scrubbed, bursting with mischief. As time passed, Robert discovered that he was good at some things in school and poor at others. He had good penmanship, with a reed pen dipped in an inkwell, and that same talent could be used for drawing. He would draw their house and the hearth and the forge and pictures of Bran and his friends at school. But he was not as good at arithmetic as he was at reading and writing or even Protestantism. Once he got the hang of Protestantism, it was easy. Catholics were bad, Protestants were good, and the King of England was the greatest man alive in the world. But arithmetic, at first, was more difficult, abstract, without a story. Then one day, near the end of the second year at St. Edmund's, it all came together in some mysterious way. Robert was adding a column of about 7 double-digit figures. He looked for the first time at the column as if it were a ladder. In his mind, he climbed up the right side, counting as he went.
12? Yes. Write down a 2 and carry the 1.
Then he climbed down the other side and had 17, wrote it down, and ended up with 172. The trick was to make it a journey, not a story with heroes and villains, just a going from one place to another, counting miles, maybe, or trees. The boy now realized that some journeys were not stories. On some journeys, nothing really happened. You just kept taking steps. Once he had that in his brain, even arithmetic seemed easy. It wasn't the same as a story, because it had no meaning, unless you were counting days and weeks and months and years and eventually centuries. The boy was 10 when they saw the strange people coming along the roads. Bran smelled them first and barked, running to the edge of the land to frighten them away from the Carson house. These strangers were ragged and thin and shambling like trees without leaves, their eyes wide with need. The sight of them filled the boy's mother with fear.
Come in now, son, she said. Come in right now.
She shouted to her husband down at the forge and then locked the doors and closed the windows. She watched the strangers from the window where Da was shooing them away with a hammer in his hand. These people terrified her, and as she held the boy close, she told him some of the story, about how such people carried with them something called the cholera,
and how his lost brothers felt pity for them and ran down with food and water, and these people, or people like them, hugged the boys and thanked them, and in 3 days the boys were dead. That night in his bed beside the wall that contained the horse's skull, Robert tried to imagine the faces of his lost brothers, tried drawing their faces in his mind. How could God let such a thing happen? He began to cry. Then the door opened, and his mother was there, wearing her double-spiraled earrings.
"It's all right, son," she said. "I'm sorry if I upset you. Don't cry anymore." "Did I ever tell you about Noah's granddaughters and how the Hebrews came to Ireland? Well, the story starts just before the flood. One granddaughter was named Sisera, and she was very smart and very good and kind. But she realized there would not be enough room for her and her woman friends on the ark. So she and her friends began to build smaller boats, and sure enough, the rains began to fall for 40 days and 40 nights, and Sisera and her friends began sailing to the west, which took 3 years, because there was no land anywhere for them to stop. And then finally, the waters of the world began to recede, and they saw land, green and rich and beautiful, and they sailed for the shore, and it was Ireland. They stayed in Ireland and married and multiplied, and some of them kept the old ways, the old religion, the religion of the Hebrews. Are you a Hebrew, Ma?
Aye, but don't be telling all your friends now. Some of them are pure stupid about Hebrews, or Jews, as they call us.
Does it make you feel any differently about me?
It feels grand, Ma. Sure, you're related to Sisera, and Rebecca, and Ruth, and Esther too, and all those others, Joshua and Samson and Abraham and Joseph.
She laughed in a delighted way.
This means I'm a Hebrew too, doesn't it?
Aye, she said, and a good one too.
The boy felt as if his mother had handed him a map to a secret treasure. One Friday evening, his father packed tools in a leather satchel, slung it over his shoulders, said a quick goodbye, and walked up the slope into the hills. Robert felt like weeping. That Sunday, he would be 9. His lucky number, the 9th day of the 9th month, and Dad walked off without discussing his return. Through the day, a rain fell upon their part of Ireland. His mother didn't mention the birthday either, acting as if it had completely vanished from her memory. When the rain eased to a steady drizzle, Robert leaned over the hall door, gazing into the dark line of the forest. He saw his father coming from the woods, riding a beautiful black horse.
"Happy birthday, son," Da said, and smiled.
He reached down and scooped up Robert with one hand and jammed him in the front of the saddle, where the boy ran his hands for the first time through the horse's lustrous coat. It was September 9, and his father had come home with a horse. His horse. Their horse. On his birthday. A rumble of distant thunder came from the south.
"Thunder," Da said. "We'll name him Thunder."
"Yes," Robert said. "Thunder! Oh, Da, thank you!"
Then all of them stood in the rain and ran their hands over the wet ebony coat of the horse named Thunder. That night they planned the fence that would mark the limits of their land and become the free home of Thunder. Da taught him to talk to Thunder always, because, he said, the horse understands.
"It's your tone of voice," he explained. "Just tell him what you want, and he'll know. Be kind to him, be gentle. And when you need him, he'll know how to be fierce."
One Saturday afternoon, Da took Robert for a ride into Belfast. Down the road past the butcher and the fishmonger and deeper into places the boy had not seen on trips with his mother. As they rode, they attracted some attention. Young boys looked up in awe at the black stallion, its massive rider, the boy in front of him, for Thunder had never been seen before in the town. They arrived finally at the waterfront, where 100 masts rose beside Donegal Quay. Da told Robert where the ships were going, and the name sounded like the words of a fairy tale. Liverpool and London, Cherbourg and Marseille, Bilbao and Morocco, and the Canary Islands, and yes, America. For the first time, the boy felt the tug of the world beyond the world he knew, moving in him like a tide.
"Those buildings are full of men who live off the sea," Das said, pointing at the low brick houses that lined the far end of the immense waterfront square. "There's a group of rich men who pull their money and share in the profits of each voyage."
"And the sailors, Da? The men on the ships? Do they get rich too?"
"Never. They die. Or they live. The voyage begins, the voyage ends. If they come back alive from the sea, they get paid. They never get rich."
Many of the storefronts bore names elegantly lettered on signs above the doors. One such business was called the Royal African Company.
"Do they sail to Africa too, Da?"
"Aye, to our eternal shame."
"And what do they trade for there?" Robert said.
"Slaves. And then they take them to America and sell them the way some men sell donkeys."
He nudged Thunder, and they trotted closer to the offices of the Royal African Company. Coming out of the front door, engulfed by six other men, was the Earl of Warren. He was fleshy and soft under his clothes, unlike the lean men of the countryside or the men who worked the ships. He said something, smiled, and they all laughed. The Earl took from his pocket three small balls, red, white, and blue, and stepped back, an amused look on his face. He planted his feet wide apart and began to juggle the balls. The group around him cheered, and Robert wanted to cheer too. He'd never seen a man do such things before. Then the Earl led the way to the corner and went into a public house.
"That's one of your slavers," Das said as the small crowd dispersed. "The Earl of Warren. The newsletter says he's bought land in America without ever seeing it. Land in New York. But mostly, it's the African trade that brings in the money."
"And does he have slaves working for him?"
"Yes, but not from Africa."
They could feel Belfast growing in their direction, even if they could not see it very clearly. His father was busier than ever. But there was one consolation after Thunder's arrival. Da could ride now to his appointments beyond their little world, and always returned more quickly. One frigid Saturday morning, while the boy's father was off on Thunder to work on a horse made lame by ill-fitting shoes, Robert and his mother set out on foot for shopping. The rain that January morning was heavy. On this day, which was January 17, 1737, after almost a week of rain, Belfast's streets were gluey with mud, rutted by the passage of carriages. His mother slipped into the fishmonger's shop, chatting, and Robert wandered outside to the street. Across the mud-jammed street, he saw his friend Tommy Hastings and called to him in the driving rain. Tommy waved, then gestured for Robbie to come over. Robert started across the street, but the mud sucked at his boots. He looked down, and the mud was above his ankles, gripping him like wet mortar. Then he heard a noise coming. From his left, he saw a black coach charging at him from 50 feet away in a blind, the horses driven wildly. The boy couldn't move. And then the boy's mother was there, grabbing him by the waist, pivoting at once, jerking him free of the mud and hurling him to safety as the horses smashed her into the mud and the steel-cased wheels rolled over her. Rebecca Carson did not scream. Her body simply issued a great whoosh, as if all the air and all the life and her very soul had been abruptly squashed out of her. It was Robert who screamed. When there were no screams left, and no voice, Robert sat splay-legged in the mud, holding his mother's ruined head, and saw through tears and rain that the black coach was stopped a dozen yards beyond them. The door opened. The Earl of Warren put a tentative foot on the runner below the door. Patch, one of the Earl's servants, he wore an eye patch, came slopping through the mud.
"Bloody stupid Irish," he said, "running in front of a coach like that."
Robert stood up, moved around Patch, and dashed to the coach. He jerked at a door handle. When it opened, the Earl stared at him with concern on his face.
"I'm sorry, lad. I didn't see what happened. But there'll be an investigation, and there'll be some compensation."
Robert leaped at the Earl, punching him, screaming,
"I'll kill you! I'll kill you, you goddamn slaver!"
All of this in a matter of seconds, And then Patch was pulling the boy off the Earl, whirling him, heaving him like a sack of potatoes through the rainy air into the mud. Then the Earl emerged and shouted, "Stop, you brainless bugger! It's his mother!" Now some of the men came from the side and lifted Robert and carried Rebecca out of the mud and laid her in front of the fishmonger's shop. "Take her home," the Earl said in a vague way to the crowd. "And the boy, too. I'll take care of everything." Behind the closed door of the bedroom, Dow washed the Irish mud off the body of his wife. He dried her. He dressed her in her best cashmere gown. He attached her double-spiraled silver earrings. Then he carried her out of the bedroom and placed her upon a pair of planks stretched across low stools beside the hearth. Then people started to arrive. "Sorry for your trouble," each of them seemed to say. "Sorry for your trouble." When everybody was gone, there was a sudden sharp knock on the door. Bran barked and barked while the boy tried to calm him. His father sighed and went to the door. A thin, trembling man stood there.
"Sorry for your trouble, Mr. Carson," the man said, "but I've got something for you."
The man peeled off a kid glove and slid an envelope from inside his coat. He handed it to Da, then bowed, turned, and was gone. The father stared at the envelope, then cracked it open with a finger. Inside there was a lone vellum card. He then showed it to his son. A single word was written with a steel pen. "Sorry." Clipped to the card was a 10-pound note.
10 pounds. That's what he thinks an Irish life is worth.
He walked past his son to the hearth and dropped the banknote in the fire. Then he turned to the boy.
"It's the two of us now, son."
Robert was awake before dawn. Da whispered to the boy to dress warmly, for they were going to the west. When he came out, his father lifted Rebecca Carson as if she were a sleeping child and told the boy to open the western door. They passed through, his father bending under the transom. Thunder was already harnessed to a cart, roofed by a small canvas tent. Da lay his wife on rush mats on the floor of the cart. Tenderly, he covered her body with the blankets, and then he and his son climbed up on the seat of the cart and started into the bruise-colored darkness, riding to the west. Bran hurried along beside them. They rode for hours, following narrow paths into dense forest. Then, from the leafy darkness, Robert heard a voice say something in a language he didn't know. A tree was speaking. His father answered back. Finally, the path ended. A wall of trees and foliage blocked their way. Da waited, and then the trees parted, and they moved forward into a wide, hidden grove. In the center was an immense flat boulder, like a stone table supported on legs chopped from the face of a mountain. There were carved markings on the boulder. Around the edges of the grove, hidden under the dark spreading branches of alder and oak, he saw tall stone columns rising 12 feet into the air, as if aimed at the stars. Thunder shuddered. Bran growled. A hawk cried from some unseen place high in the sky. Then from the trees came some of the men who had visited Da in the evenings when his mother was alive. Their women were behind them, and some white-bearded men in long dark gowns, all of them speaking that language. None of them wept. 4 of the women lifted Rebecca Carson from the wagon and carried her to the flat boulder, which Robert now realized was an altar. Da took his son's hand and led him to the head of the altar, where they stood together behind the woman they had lost. At the foot of the altar, an old woman, whose name the boy would learn was Mary Morrigan, began to chant. The old woman came to John Carson and took each of his hands and brought him to a clear spot between 2 of the stone columns. One of the gowned old men handed Da an oak-handled shovel. He turned the first wet clod of black earth, and then 3 of his friends joined him. They dug until the lip of the long rectangular trench was almost even with John Carson's shoulders. Then they paused. A robed man offered each a hand to climb out of the grave. Robert followed his father as he walked back to the altar where the body of Rebecca Carson lay, and a burly man produced a goatskin bag, translucent and plump with liquid. He handed it to Da, who drank of it, then passed it to the man on his right, who passed it to Robert. The taste was harsh and bitter in the boy's mouth, but he swallowed the liquid and knew to hand the bag to the next man. Robert felt his stomach burning. The old woman was the last to drink. Then his father lifted his wife's body for the final time and carried her to the grave. He realized then that his mother was not wearing her spiraled earrings, and he felt better. At least his father would have them as a sign of his loving her, and being loved back. Finally, John Carson grabbed his son's offered hands and climbed out of the grave. With a spade, he began to cover her. He threw down 7 loads of black earth and then handed the shovel to the boy.
7, he said. Only 7.
And then John Carson handed the shovel to one of his friends, and he to another. Soon she was covered, a black mound rising above her grave. Then the old woman began to sing. Her pure, ethereal voice seemed to rise from the bowels of the earth and reach to the roof of the sky. When she was finished, Bran howled from his place on the edge of the woods. After a long silence, Robert found the strength to talk to his father.
So, we're not Christians then, are we?
No.
Are we Jews then?
No.
Is it Catholics we are?
No.
What are we then, Da?
We're Irish, son, he said quietly.
We're Irish.
Part 2. The Arctic Heart. That night at home, before the hearth, the father told his son their true names. They were O'Connors, not Carsons. Da's true name was Fergus O'Connor. His son was Cormac Samuel O'Connor. The O'Connor name went all the way back through history, the father said, back before the settlers arrived from Scotland a century earlier, back before the Normans, back before St. Patrick arrived with his lonely Christian god, and before the Viking invasions, all the way back, in fact, to the arrival of the Celts.
We've lived a long secret, the father whispered, and it will remain a secret, lad.
Why?
Because this is a country where religion can be dangerous. They will kill you for having one, or for having the old religion, which to some is like having no religion at all.
And where does the Samuel come from in my true name?
From your mother. Her true name was Rebecca Samuels. She wanted the name to live in you.
Do we have a religion?
Aye, he whispered. We call it the old religion.
He was about to explain when they heard Bran barking. Then there was a knock on the door.
Who is it?
They heard the muffled voice of the Reverend Robinson. Da opened the door.
We have a question for you, Robinson said.
The boy's father, Fergus O'Connor, looked at the preacher in a blank way. It's about her burial, I suppose. Silence for a long moment. The boy thought,
her name was Rebecca Samuels. She was a Jew.
Reverend Robinson said,
she was not buried in our churchyard.
Fergus O'Connor folded his arms across his chest.
She is buried in the West, Da said, according to her wishes. That leads to another question, Mr. Carson. Are you Catholics?
We're not Catholics. You see us every Sunday at your chapel.
There are many hidden papists here.
I've answered your questions. Good night, Reverend Robinson. Try to stay dry, and don't fear. I'll control the dog.
Late on an afternoon, after the visit from the Reverend Robinson, Fergus O'Connor began to make the sword. He did this with Cormac's help. All of this was done in a day. When the sword cooled but was not cold, he used a needle-pointed burin to etch 2 figures into the broadest part of the sword, just below the handle. 2 spirals, thin at the top, curling around, then widening at the bottom, like sea serpents, 1 on each side, matching the spiral earrings of Fergus O'Connor's wife.
It's very beautiful, Da.
Aye, he said, but it's not meant to do beautiful things.
They took turns polishing the blade, using a file crosswise on its flat sides, emery cloth for the fine edges. The boy could see his face in the polished steel and thought,
You are Cormac.
The cutting edge was like a razor. He glanced at his father, staring into the fire.
And he is Fergus.
The next few years, Cormac received three separate educations. As young Robert Carson, he heard one version of the tale of the world at St. Edmund's, the one about the civilizing glories of the British Empire, saving savages from the idol worship inflicted by the whore of Babylon who ruled in Rome. They heard about brave Sir Francis Drake and his daring battles against the corrupt Spanish and treacherous French. And even Cormac O'Connor, safe behind his Robert Carson mask, found those tales thrilling. Cormac O'Connor was learning other histories. To begin with, Irish history.
Our present, his father said, is also our past.
They talked much about the penal laws, which still existed today in their Ireland. The O'Connors were saved from their brutality by the success of their disguises, by being Carsons. But the vicious penal laws were destroying thousands of innocent Catholic men, women, and children. Under these laws, no Catholic could vote or hold public office. No Catholic could study science or go to a foreign university. No Catholic could buy land or even lease it. The most absurd of the penal laws stated that no Catholic could own a horse worth more than £5. Any Protestant could look at a Catholic's horse, say it was worth £6, or £30, or £1,000, and take it from him on the spot.
If you can break a man's heart, Das said, you can destroy his will. Even poor Thunder must be a Protestant horse.
And so Fergus began telling his son the longer story, too, the one not told in school. They were part of that story, as the Hidden Grove was a defiant remnant of unconquered Ireland, unconquered by either Rome or London. In the schoolroom at St. Edmund's, the boy learned the names of English kings and English heroes. He read the Magna Carta. He recited English ideals. But as his father told him the story of Ireland, his mind also teemed with Celts and Vikings, informers and traitors, and murder after murder after murder. The Irish were here before Jesus Christ was even born. So were their gods. Still, in all that he said to his son, he insisted there were men in Ireland who cared for true justice. "There's a fellow in Dublin, the Dean, they call him," he said one night. "Jonathan Swift. You must read his Drapier's letter, son. I have them in a bound book, hidden out in the stable. He's a man with justice in his heart. A Protestant, but an Irishman first. And you must begin reading the newspapers. The newsletter here is run by fair men. The Dean writes for the Dublin Journal, and I have some of those hidden here, too."
"Why do you hide them, Da?"
"Because of the bloody injustice here, lad. Some writers expose the injustice, and just reading about it will make you a suspect. And whenever there's trouble in Ulster, every suspect dies."
"Are we suspects, Da?"
The older man paused for a long moment. "I think we are," he said. On Sundays, father and son trudged to St. Edmund's to inhale the odors of an orderly piety. Each wore his mask. An hour later, they mounted Thunder and trotted into the glens behind the Black Mountain. There, beyond observation, Sunday after Sunday, with a kind of religious intensity, the father showed his son the power of the sword. Fergus showed Cormac the principles of balance and the way to shift weight, sliding forward on one leg, not leaping, but pushing on the back leg. Back at the forge, they never displayed the sword in the open air, afraid that some spy might be watching. One late night, Fergus designed a map case for the sword. That was the way they carried it while traveling. In the forge, when Cormac was not sharing the work, his father made him lift iron and steel, the weight always increasing. Cormac's muscles grew harder and tauter, and in the dark Sunday forests, the sword felt lighter. And his father established codes. Never use a sword on someone who can't fight back. Don't drink, ever, because drink makes the wits rust, and you can die without a fight. If you draw your sword, prepare to kill with it or to die. "And tell none of these to any man," he said. "He must never know what you're thinking. That's the business of yourself, lad." Across two summers,
Cormac became a Celt. He was taken by his father to the sacred grove and placed in the care of Mary Morrigan. Each time his father left, Cormac hated the moment of separation, and so did Thunder and Bran, who were going back with Fergus. But when they were gone, the old woman led Cormac through the woods to the mouth of a cave on the slope of a hill. Here the young man slept on furs while becoming an Irishman. Mary Morrigan taught him the Irish language, with its 18 letters, starting with the words for man, far, and woman, ban, and bread, uran, and water, ishka. She taught him how to say, I want, and then she began talking in Irish to him. As he moved around the forest that surrounded the grove, he understood that it was actually a village with trees separating and hiding the houses. About 600 people were hiding there from the world. Mary Morrigan introduced Cormac to the men and the women and young people, and all of them spoke to him in Irish. He listened and nodded shyly and remained mute. Then one morning, Mary Morrigan asked him in Irish whether he had slept well, and he answered her in Irish.
Yes, I've slept well.
The key had turned in the lock, the way he had climbed a magic ladder into arithmetic. By the end of summer, he was not simply speaking Irish, he was thinking in Irish, and yes, dreaming. She instructed him about the seasons and the great feasts. Across those years, a new calendar was being added to his sense of time, the calendar of Ireland. All those great feasts revolved about the land and the sun, and the marvelous gifts they granted to mortals. Beside the fire in the cave, on rainy summer nights, Mary Morrigan explained to him about the other world.
The other world is beneath us, she said,
gesturing with a leathery hand to the ground beneath them. The other world was a place, as she described it, not a mere story or an abstract idea, and it was reachable through raised mounds called Shees. Down there lived people called the Tuatha De Danann, who had been in Ireland before the Celts, a race of poets and warriors who fought to maintain their place and then, after one final defeat, had retreated beneath the surface of the earth. Ever since, the Irish, when they died, had been following them into the earth. There was enchanted music down there, she said, and endless games and eternal feasting. There was no such thing as old age or even time.
Who gets in and who's kept out? He asked.
The just are admitted, the unjust barred, she said. The Christians borrowed all that from us.
So my mother is there?
Aye. If you live a just life, you'll see her there. Of that there is no doubt. Sure didn't we help her into the other world from this very spot.
Who else is barred?
Those who fail to avenge injustice, she said. If an unjust act is done in the family of a man or woman, it must be avenged. That is the rule. And suicides. Those who cannot live with the pain of the world and kill themselves are barred forever.
On many smoky evenings, she told him tales of the other world. Sometimes the other people emerged into our world from the emerald caves, disguised as fawns or birds or beautiful women, and lured our heroes back down into their secret world.
And do the other people live only in the Shi?
No, Cormac. The Shi is the entrance. That would be like trying to live in a doorway.
The other world, she explained, stretched everywhere. It was possible during the Feast of Samhain to enter the other world, but no human should go before it was time. And there was a dark part of the other world too, she said, ruled over by Don, the lord of the bad Irish dead, full of immense serpents, red horsemen, the walls hung with severed heads. She didn't dwell on this, and Cormac was pleased. It sounded too much like the Reverend Robinson's Christian hell.
When your time arrives, she said, and you have lived your full portion and added to decency in this world, then you too can live in the other world. You can unite with all those you once loved here.
Hearing these tales, Cormac looked differently at the land, imagining those who lived beneath him, including his mother and his two lost brothers. Then came the night near the end of his second summer in the Irish grove.
Cormac noticed Mary Morrigan staring long and hard at the fire in a kind of absolute solitude.
A bad time is coming, she said in Irish. There'll be starving and wailing and killing. You'll hear the banshee cry in the night.
She poked the fire with a blackened oak stick.
You'd best get ready, she said. It's coming.
Later, her words made him toss and shift beneath a thin muslin blanket. He must warn his father. Mary Morrigan would speak her truth to the tribe, but Cormac must tell his father. Turning now in the damp, peat-smelling darkness of the cave, he wished his mother were there. He wished she could rise from the place where she was buried, only a few hundred feet from this cave, emerge from the emerald light of the other world, and describe to him what she knew and the truth of what she'd seen, thinking, as he remembered the rules set by Mary Morrigan, I need to earn my way to the other world. I need to build my courage. I need to forge my passion. I need to avenge all unjust acts committed against family and tribe. I must learn to live with the pain of the world until my time comes. Then I will see my mother. Then I will see my lost brothers. He fell asleep trying to imagine the sound of the banshee. Then he was awake. An hour later, or 3 hours, he could not tell. The fire dozed, and in its light he saw the leathery face of Mary Morrigan very close to his own. Her grainy fingertips touched his cheek. She was kneeling beside him.
You're a good lad, she whispered,
and then leaned down and kissed him. She shuddered. So did he. Then, with a wind rising beyond the cave mouth, rustling the trees before it, her hard, granular skin fell away, vanishing into the dark, orangey air, and Cormac O'Connor was afraid. Looking down at him was a woman with an oval face framed by thick ringlets of black hair, eyes lustrous and hungry. Dark Rosaline of the old, sad Celtic song. She moved his blanket aside and played with the bone buttons of his coarse blue shirt. No words were spoken. She eased out of the ragged clothes of Mary Morrigan, naked now in the firelight, shifted above him and his tense, sweating body, and held in her dark, smooth-skinned hand her smooth, full, dark-nippled breast and offered it to his mouth. He took it, hard-nippled, brown-nippled, dark-skinned woman, suckling him, dark-skinned woman with hair falling like a black flower from her head as he tried to suck all she knew, all she was offering, all she could give him. Her soft, smooth, kneading hand, damp and cool as the dark air, found his bursting cock, and slowly, smoothly, moistly, firmly she began then to move him out of himself, out of that place, out of time, into the future. He told his father none of this, of course, when he came for Cormac in the morning.